Good morning. Thanks for the opportunity to speak with you for 10 to 12 minutes. Sharing a little bit of our research on the impact of climate change on wild species related to crops, and talking a little bit about constraints to migration of wild species. And speaking of that, the first author wasn't able to migrate here from because of visa issues as well, so that's why I'm giving the speech. Hopefully, I will do an adequate job for you. And this is part of a larger project related to crop aurelias around the world. It may be of interest to some of you in terms of accessing germplasm. All of the material is available to the global community, so I'll speak about that just at the end, especially if there's interest about it. Essentially, we're going to touch on climate change, which you all know about a lot, wild relatives, and then talk about what we did to understand what changes might happen in the distribution of these wild species due to climate change up to 2050, and what we might do about it in terms of conservation. So I would guess that as an agricultural community, of course, we think a lot about impact on crop yields and adaptation or mitigation. I myself don't often think so much about what's going to happen with wild species these days, and sort of turning my head to that. Again, it's interesting to see the IPCC report basically at this point to 2014, the current report that's come out, we don't have solid examples of wild plant or wild animal species being lost completely due to climate change. We do have this example of a frog species, I believe from Costa Rica, I'm not sure if that's true, that is now extinct due to changes in actually the habitat of its pathogen. But we think that it's coming. And so these are just categories of life forms. On the far left right here, those are plants, and then there's animals and amphibia, birds, mammals. This is the quantity of, or the distribution of their species that will be lost up to 2080. The blue line is irrelevant at this point. That's if we basically curb our emissions entirely by 2016. That's not going to happen for sure. Green line is if our peak emissions are by 2030, I believe, and red line is business as usual. So if business as usual happens by 2080, the projection is up to 60% of our plant species will lose more than half of their distributions around the world. It's pretty awful. So then there comes up the issue of what plant species do about this forcing of change in climate. And of course, plant species will try to migrate. Then the question is, will they migrate fast enough? Easier, of course, for birds than it is for plants. So over a bunch of different plant species, the pollen records tell us that on average, maybe 100 to 1,000 meters a year. I did quick math yesterday, and as I understand it, by 2050, which is what our study is about, that's about 36 kilometers on average for a plant species to migrate. Nothing. So as far as I can tell, migration is pretty much out for most of our crop wild relatives. Correct me if I'm wrong at the end there. If you look at other studies for certain species, chloroplast data for American beech, it's much, much lower than 1,000 meters a year. It's less than 100 meters a year. I'm speaking to great folks here in crop wild relative use, so I don't think I'll even mention this slide other than for those of you who don't work directly in crop wild relatives, these are wild plants highly related to crops. And they've been used for many decades now for crop improvement to great success. So we're interested in their conservation, both in situ and then ex situ in gene banks, so that plant breeders can use them. And we're interested in their use for food security. There's been a couple of studies in the past, including I think a couple of folks in this room that have looked at what might happen with wild relatives, climate change. These colors are a bit unfortunate. This is looking at wild relatives related to three crops. The top one there is peanuts, the middle one is cowpea, and the bottom one are wild relatives of potato. Again, these are wild species, and these are just species richness maps of where the species occur. The colors are unfortunate because they're all red here, but basically the far left column there is our current, and the middle is what's going to happen. But the third column is what you want to look at, because those colors are the more important ones. The blue might be positive change. The red, though, is the negative change projected. And those far numbers, 26, 31, and 79, are our full number of species projected to be lost. My talk won't be this depressing, hopefully, the whole thing, but we start out that way. So what we did, working within a global project focused on crop wild relatives that's looking at collecting these species around the world and conserving them, is we looked at these very species related to 29 globally important crops, a total of about 450 wild species. We modeled their distributions based on software and inputs of climatic layers, and then we modeled what their distributions would be like in 2050, based on scenarios of climate forcing over time. These are our crops. For those of you familiar with the project itself, these are the crops, the full set of 29 crops that are being looked at. It's most of, let's say, the globally important food security crops. And the wild species we looked at are the closer relatives to those species. I think right here I'll just touch on, there's this website that you can go to that has quite a wealth of material now on who these species are, where they're distributed around the world, and where their gaps are in their ex situ collections. That's been the most of our research so far. The map on the bottom is our data set, which is up to almost 6 million records around the world of where these species occur. That's data based on herbaria and gene banks. That material is also available to you if you'd like it, that resource. It will be available online and through GBIF this year, but get in touch with me if you're interested in earlier than then. We used Maxent modeling, which is a standard technique for modeling species distributions. You use bioclimatic variables as inputs, that is temperature and precipitation, looking at how similar is locations in the world to the points where we know a species has already been collected or where a species is. And the model says, okay, if this temperature and precipitation, altitude and other things are similar enough, that's where we think a species lives. We do the same thing for 2050 based on how much we think temperature and precipitation, the things are going to change, and we say, okay, well, that's where we think a species can live 36 years from now. We used, we cut down the number of variables that we put in, which is a useful technique to avoid overfitting with Maxent. and we used RCP 4.5, which at this point is also kind of a, let's say, a conservative idea of what's going to happen in our future. 4.5 is the red line there, and we looked at 2050. So that's our cut on how much emissions are going to be facing our wild relatives. And we used a large set of circulation models as an ensemble. So what do we actually do? Okay, so we took points like this. This is where a species is known to occur. This is a wild relative potato in the Andes. We did our Maxent modeling for current distribution right now, and that green area is where we think the species basically potentially can occur. We did that same model for the future, and you end up with a model like that, and maybe that doesn't look too different at the moment. So then we can put some colors to it and understand what might be happening. The gray is no real change in overall distribution. The blue is some new change, new positive possible change given migration possibility. And the red is loss. And that's essentially our method for understanding what might be happening in situ to wild relatives over 36 years. So here's really the results slide thus far. This is kind of a preliminary. We're going to be doing this for quite a longer list of crops and a couple of other different forcing pathways to understand. Again, 4.5 is pretty moderate, and we're likely to be having more emissions, therefore more difficult for basically for the plant species. So as we mentioned before, this idea of migration for me seems to be pretty limited, unless we're talking about assisted migration at this point, which is actually helping plant species to move. But that right area is, if we assume that plant species can move and very quickly over 36 years and get to those blue areas right here, then over a gene pool, you'll get, if you don't mind me saying, the possibility over here of some crops, the wild relatives of some crops actually gaining in some distribution area. This is much more likely right here, which is the crop relatives not being able to move into new areas. And this is our negatives from zero, which is the present, a loss in overall area. This is a median change across all the wild relatives related to each of those crops. So, I guess the take-home message right there should be we're projecting quite a loss of habitat for wild relatives over the next few years. It varies across gene pools. There's gene pools that seem to be able to withstand those sort of changes better than others. Some of the gene pools that are most affected include the millets and cowpea, potato, carrot, oats, and lentils. So what should we do about this? Obviously, the populations and the species that are going to be impacted quite negatively, the first order of business, I would say, is collecting for ex situ conservation, certainly for populations that haven't been collected. Those species or populations that don't have much change, maybe we just monitor them and see what happens. I would think we would probably collect them as well just to be safe. And the ones that are projected to have suitable new area, I guess the real question is whether assisted migration at this point is something that could be considered if we're interested in their persistence in situ. Assisted migration is something that's just sort of being talked about and not yet explored. And certainly not yet for crop wild relatives, unless maybe someone can speak up about if anyone has any experience with that. It's difficult to transfer wild plants into new areas and think that they're going to survive as well as they do in their original habitats. It looks like I have one more minute, so I'm just going to mention the project. This is a global project over 10 years, from 2011 to 2021. It's funded by the government of Norway, and it's managed by the Global Crop Diversity Trust and the Royal Botanic Garden of Kew, and it involves quite a large list of gene banks and herbaria around the world. The effort is to collect and conserve wild relatives of these 29 crops and also gather data about quite a long list of other wild relatives. All of that information, all of the germplasm, wild germplasm, and pre-read lines of that are available to the global community. So please see me if you're interested more in the project. Thanks very much.
Thank you. There is time for a question. Yes?
Some of these wild relatives are weeds, and actually they're expanding. And we have, in the wheat group, we have quite a few weedy aegilops that are expanding here in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
How many? What percentage of these wild relatives are aggressive weeds?
Yeah. So the question, the question, which is a very good one, is or a remark that wild relatives can be quite weedy, and that is actually an interesting one. Are wild relatives kind of should they be compared as normal wild plants around the world? Because many of them are quite weedy. They grow in roadsides, disturbed habitat. Those studies of wild relatives expanding in the United States, I'm not sure that those are related directly to climate change. They're certainly related to wide adaptability over disturbed habitats and all of that. The question is how many wild relatives are invasive exotics or weedy. I think the estimate, if I can give an off-the-record almost estimate of that, certainly a quarter of them are quite weedy, and those would be the ones that are more generalist and probably do better under climate change and under all the other disturbing factors happening to wild plants around the world, which are much more obviously of an issue right now, not climate change. The real issues are urbanization, of habitat destruction, and all these other issues. But there are that whole other set of wild relatives that are perennials that are locally adapted and rare, and those are probably the ones that we should focus on first. Wheat, of course, is one of the more weedy, those guys, than these other ones.
So the idea has been kicked around in the past of creating reserves in areas of primary diversity where wild relatives will continue to evolve in response to climate change. Is that gaining any traction?
Okay, so the question is about thinking about in situ reserves and what's the state of thought on that. There's been a couple of large JEF projects under the Convention on Biological Diversity that I know of that have looked particularly in the Fertile Crescent at in situ conservation, specifically of wild relatives, establishing in Syria, I think possibly in Turkey, a few other locations. There is a nascent effort within FAO to create a global plan for the in situ conservation of wild relatives through a series of reserves around the world. That's not yet enacted, but it's kind of in planning. As we know, in situ conservation is quite expensive. The actual purchase of land for that purpose, I think, is always a challenge. So the idea with that project is to really identify real hot spots around the world where you're going to conserve the most in one place and try to get some money there to conserve them.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.